You are listening to Russia on the Record, a podcast from the Moscow Times. As Russia opens a new front in its invasion of Ukraine, the country has a new defense minister this week, the economist Andrei Belousov. Who is he, and what does his appointment mean for Russia's war machine? We're going to try and answer those questions this week, but first, here's a roundup of the rest of the week's news. Russia's new offensive against Ukraine is continuing along three fronts. As well as the advance towards the strategically significant town of Chasiv Yar, west of Bakhmut in the Donetsk region, Russian forces have continued to capture Ukrainian villages along the border in the Kharkiv region, where thousands of people have been evacuated from their villages. Kharkiv city itself continues to be affected. For example, 20 people were injured by Russian strikes on Tuesday. Kyiv claims that this front has been partially stabilised, but acknowledges that the situation is dynamic and could, as a result, change quickly. Analysts believe that the offensive in the Kharkiv region is an attempt by Russia to create a buffer zone between the two countries that would stop Ukraine from attacking Russian territory. There are also suggestions that it could be a diversionary tactic to draw Kyiv's attention away from fighting in the east and further south, where Russia claims it has captured the small town of Robotnye, rolling back one of the few successes from Ukraine's underwhelming summer 2023 counteroffensive. Last week on Russia on the Record, we discussed the controversial foreign influence bill being debated in the Georgian parliament, which critics say mirrors Russia's foreign agents law. This week, it was approved, drawing condemnation from foreign governments and international agencies who are concerned Tbilisi could repress civil society and drift into Moscow's orbit. The European Union told the Georgian government that if the law was enacted, it would freeze the country's bid to join the bloc. At the time of recording, Vladimir Putin is in China on his first foreign trip since being re-elected earlier this year. The Kremlin says that Putin and Xi Jinping will discuss ways to expand their country's cooperation. Beijing casts itself as a neutral party amid the war in Ukraine, but it has acted as a crucial economic lifeline to Russia since the full-scale invasion in 2022. In an interview with Chinese state media, Putin hailed Beijing's genuine desire to help resolve the Ukraine war, signalling that the two countries were aligned on the conflict's geopolitical causes. Putin has also appointed five regional governors, including in the Kursk region, which has suffered from Ukrainian drone, cluster munition, and missile strikes over recent months. This week in Belgorod nearby, 20 people were killed in a Ukrainian missile strike, 17 of whom died when an apartment building collapsed after being hit by a missile fragment. And Sri Lanka says that 16 of its citizens have been killed in Ukraine. Although the government did not confirm which side they were fighting for, there have been reports that citizens of several South Asian countries, including Nepal and India, have been lured to Russia on promises of well-paid work, only to be recruited into the Russian army. The Russian government's cabinet reshuffle this week saw many ministers retain their posts, but the most high-profile outcome was the replacement of Defence Minister Sergei Shoigu, who's held the post since 2012, with the economist Andrei Belousov. Belousov previously served as first Deputy Prime Minister, a role responsible for coordinating Russia's economic and foreign policy. Shoigu himself was moved to Secretary of the Security Council, which coordinates Russia's national security policy, replacing longtime Putin ally Nikolai Patrushev, who's been appointed to act as a presidential aide. This week, we talked with Ruben Enikolopov, a political economist and professor at the Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona, about what to expect from this new defense minister. Did Shoigu's departure come as a surprise to you, or even others in Putin's cabinet?
Well, actually, the departure of Shoigu did not come as a surprise. I think there was a very clear signal when his deputy was put into jail. That was right before the reshuffling. We know how these bureaucratic games are played. That was a very clear signal to what was going on. I was surprised by who was appointed as his successor. That's true. You know, ex ante, it was surprising. Ex post, it looks pretty rational. But the departure of Shoigu, on top of that, I think like there are two reasons. Like one, it was a signal. Another, there's a political logic into it. It's actually currently the moment where Russian military seems to be getting an upper hand. So basically, they are on offense. And basically, I think that for political reasons, should not be the case that Shoigu is the one who gets credit for that. So he should have been removed during this process so that he cannot claim that he was the one behind the success. So that was another political logic, purely kind of, you know, autocratic political logic in doing this. So that was not surprising, basically.
You've said that you were surprised by the appointment of Belousov. So what is the significance of the fact that Shoigu has been replaced by a man who is not only a civilian with no military background, but also an economist?
That, I think, confirms two things. First, that this is a really a war of attrition, that the success in the military sense of this word is mostly driven by the ability of on the Russian part to produce missiles, to produce all the necessary equipment, etc., for a long and sustained period of time. So Ukraine depends mostly on the support of the allies. Russia depends on this enormous investment in its military complex. And that is here to stay. So that is kind of the signal to the other party that we are prepared to fight this war for years. And that's on the one side. It's like if you try to understand from a military point of view why it is important to appoint someone like Belousov, who is let's start with the fact that he's known to be a highly capable technocratic bureaucrat and not involved in any corruption scandals. So he really believes, he's ideologically close to the ideas of Putin on what is the right future of Russia. So he's actually very reliable, very efficient as an economist. And that, again, from a military point of view, it's important because it basically tells signals that we are prepared to win the war of attrition. From an economic point of view, it also makes sense because basically, more and more so, the military complex becomes the main driver of economic growth in Russia. Yes, there was some initial boost to the economy also by this import substitution, because if you like remove parts of the foreign companies, you have to invest, you have to fill this void. But it's a temporary thing. It plays a role while you're stepping in and you are substituting foreign production with a local one. But after that, something else has to be pushing the economy further. And currently, this is mostly done by government spending, and predominantly government spending goes to military complex. So that, like, so military depends on the economy now because of the type of war we have. But the economy depends on the war also because of the type of economy we're having now. So it's in some sense, in exposed again, I think it's kind of logical that Belousov was appointed. It's a very bold move to move someone like a pure civilian economist as a head of the Ministry of Defense, but it makes sense from the pure logical perspective.
Tell me more about Belousov's background. You mentioned that he has a strong ideological opposition to corruption.
He's really like an economist, he's grew up in a family of economists. He's an economist. He has very good reputation as a person who built a central forecasting center, which is still is one of the most professional centers currently in Russia. Like it's run not by him by now, but he was created by him. So from the pure technocratic point of view, even by people who disagree with his strategy, like me, for example, I have deep respect for him as a professional. But it's also clear that he has his own view of the strategy of the development of Russia, very globally, which is rare for technocrats. He has a very strategic view, basically imperialistic view of Russia, that in terms of competition with great powers. And that's why he firmly believes that the state should play a much bigger role in the economy compared to at least to what it used to be before. Maybe he's satisfied now. He also believes that Russia should be much more self-reliant in terms of production because of its competition between empires, etc. He was, again, these are rumors, but entirely kind of believable. He was the only one from all the economic bloc of the government who supported the Crimea annexation 10 years ago. And he really believes in it. So that's for sure. In that sense, even his opponents, I think, nobody does. He's an honest person. He just follows the principles that he has. And he is so close to Putin, not on personal loyalty, like many of the people who won from the system, who personally benefit, and they can change their mind if someone else is offering something good. He has the same ideas, the same values, which makes him a much more loyal person to this government and much more reliable. So that's why I think like he has a full trust of Putin for these reasons. And he's in what he's doing, he's very effective. That's kind of, I think, undeniable. Well, obviously, his background has nothing to do with military. So that will be a big challenge to him. But again, it looks like it's also kind of aligned with the type of economy, how he thinks about it. This managed economy with like input output matrices, like Soviet style planned economy. Like, he's a smart guy, so he understands that the market mechanism should be the main ones, but still the way he looks at the economy is like this, which is actually fits very well the type of economy, the military economy, because there market mechanisms do not really work. It's nobody knows how to price military goods around the world. It's not a Russian phenomenon. Like how much should you pay for a missile that will be destroyed like in a month? Like, who knows? So it's clearly non-market principles. So these kind of ideas of central planning, input metric matrices, is like old style. I actually well fitted for a military complex. So I think like that, at least that makes him a good fit. If you choose one economist to run Ministry of Defense, Dan Belousov is a good fit. The question is like whether you should appoint an economist as the head of the defense. That's another question. But that's what they did.
If Belousov's background in economics is unusual for a defense minister to have, does he have any qualities which could be weaknesses?
He's also a very tough guy. He has his principles, and he is not afraid like to push them through. And that is important in such a difficult ministry, like a Ministry of Defense. Well, he will be running people who are very different, with very different background, like his subordinates, like completely from different culture. So that's why I think that explains a lot why his first speech as a minister was all about money that go to military, etc. He needs to get the support of his subordinates. He is clearly by them, like he's regarded as like a complete outsider. Even the previous ones, like kind of, actually the most of the minister of, I think all of, in the recent past, if you look at the ministers of defense, they were not military people, like they, by training, but not to that extreme as Belousov, like had nothing to do like with military before. So he has to win the hearts and minds of his subordinates. And that's why his first speech was about like all the goodies that he will be bringing for people who are in military now. So that's kind of politically against very, very reasonable, his actions. But I don't know him personally. I met him. I know him indirectly. But from whatever I know about him, his personality traits also kind of fit well the military part.
As you said, Shoigu's deputy Timur Ivanov has been arrested and accused of accepting $12 million in bribes just a few weeks ago. And at least five other members of the defense ministry have been arrested since then. Will it be a challenge for Belousov to reform a ministry that has so many flaws?
Yes, that's a huge challenge. I think that making any ministry of defense in any country non-corrupt is an illusion. There are too many temptations. I mean, you produce something that got destroyed in a month. Like, you cannot even prove what you've produced. So obviously, it's like the incentives to cheat are enormous. The question is obviously the extent of corruption. So can he reduce corruption? And that's a huge, huge challenge. I think that will be one of the main challenges that he faces, because there will be a lot of people who will be fighting back. Because there are a lot of people who are benefiting from the system monetarily, big time. So I think that actually this is the most, like, people talk about technological issues of putting like input output, like whatever, critical import substituting with the Russian production, which is also a big challenge, obviously. But I think that actually trying to make work such a corrupt ministry is the biggest challenge for him. And it's not clear whether, and again, I have no doubts that he himself wants to do it. He's never been accused of anything related to military corruption. But he's just one person in a completely corrupt ministry. So we'll see who wins.
And finally, in his first speech after his appointment, Belousov said that every part of the country must work together to achieve victory. Is this an indication that Russia is going to develop further into a war economy? And what could that look like?
I'm not sure there's much room left to expand. As even like Peskov admitted, basically the share of military expenditures, even modestly, like lower bound, if you don't consider other like national security things, is already achieving the level of Soviet Union. And we all know that was one of the challenges and eventually problems that led to the collapse of Soviet Union. Obviously, the situation is very different. Russia is not a planned economy. There's a huge, huge intervention of government, obviously. But the main mechanisms are still in all the sectors apart from the military one. Even in the military, they're trying to be like, they're like market-based So obviously we cannot draw parallels in this sense, but it is a troubling level of military expenditures, obviously. And I don't think there's any room to expand. It's already enormous. So the question, I think, is how people perceive it. Because, you know, when we look at numbers of GDP, all the economists who work with GDP know that this, you have to be careful with these numbers. First, they are not necessarily correlated with the welfare of people. Because if you can produce a lot of military equipment and blow it up, and GDP will be going up, the quality of life of your citizens will not be going up, and the quality of life of people around you will be going down. So this is one thing. Like GDP is one thing, quality of welfare, quality of life of the citizens is another one. That's again, here we can draw parallels with Soviet Union. If you look at GDP, it was very loosely connected with the quality of life of people, exactly because a huge part of GDP was going to military combat. So that is one challenge of GDP. Another challenge of GDP, especially with military production, is again, you have no idea how to put value on these things that are being produced. Because usually, normally, with like there are market prices, you know, so we produce, I don't know, 10 pairs of shoes and we know the price. That's like, if you produce 10 missiles, like what's the contribution to GDP? It's very arbitrary. So the main challenge is, so GDP numbers are used for like, you know, propagandistic kind of goals in all countries. But in Russia, in particular case, it's a big thing. So if we want to understand how people, actually citizens are, like Russian citizens are feeling, look at the disposable income, other measures that are measuring welfare of them. And here again, there's no, it's not a collapse, it's not a problem, but it's going kind of up. But still, we have to understand that this real disposable income of Russians is still lower than 2013 when this whole campaign began. So it is a problem. People do adapt, people rally around the flag with this war, etc. But this is, you all know from the experience of other countries, this is always a temporary phenomenon. You can mobilize people and get them agitated for several years. If you look at the whatever, in Vietnam War in US, for several years, everyone was happy, like our country is fighting the communists, etc. After several years, it completely collapsed, mostly because people, citizens of the country got tired and wanted to stop the conflict. This is the main challenge, actually, for the war as of attrition. Like the war in which Russia is well now, the type of war, is that the war of attrition, like that, it basically, like you fight until someone runs out of resources. But there are two types of resources, material resources that you have to produce and, you know, like support, like moral resources of the people of your country who support this conflict. So I think that currently, obviously in Kremlin, they do understand it very well. So this currently what Belousov was saying about mobilizations is trying to get another kick to this rally around the flag phenomenon, so that people are still kind of thinking that, well, okay, forget about economic development. What is more important is war. We all mobilize. We all as a country work for this. Because even the regions, they do not produce anything, well, or very little for military complex. They suffer because their economy is not developing, because all the resources are moved to it. So they have to feel that, okay, I'm contributing. By not increasing my production in the civilian circle, I'm contributing to war efforts. So that's moral support. But ultimately, again, this is a temporary phenomenon. We are already in this situation for 2 years. I don't know how many years it can be sustained. So at some point, the economic part, the quality of life of the Russians will become more important driver that would actually explain their lingering support for the war. Whether the support by normal Russians has any bearing on the decisions of the Kremlin to continue the war or not, it's another question. It's a purely authoritarian country. And as any authoritarian country, obviously, still, there are constraints on autocrat by the citizens. You cannot do, like, it's not a tyranny old ages. But they are not as correlated as they are in democracies. But still, it plays a role, so that people have to be, like, minimally satisfied, so economy will be playing a big role in the years to come.
That's all for this week. You can follow the Moscow Times on social media to keep up to date with the most important stories from Russia. And if you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Russia on the Record to gain access to all of our episodes.